All right, I want to make clear in starting with this that I am intending in this class to be dealing with spiritual issues and not political ones or personality ones. I want you to understand that before we even begin, and I'll say it more than once as we go along. And yet, I think that the ways in which we maybe take in and process the kinds of things that we're going to be talking about will require you and I to consider and to be able to form in our own mind a picture of what it is that we're dealing with as Christians. A good way for us to start, I think, will be for us to define what do we mean by the term culture. I noted in the bulletin that I want to study how do we, as the Lord's church, how do we conduct ourselves? How do we live our lives? How do we go about our work when we realize not only that we are different from the popular culture, but that in some ways we are unwelcome in the popular culture? How do we conduct ourselves in that way? So in order to do this, let's start by defining for ourselves what we mean by culture.
A group of people with common beliefs.
All right, a group of people with common beliefs. That would be a succinct way of saying it. Go a little farther with me. How do I feel or comprehend or confront culture in my everyday life? If culture is a group of people with common beliefs, can you say that there is an American culture that I deal with every day? You're invited to talk. Okay.
There's a lot of subculture you deal with every day.
All right, there are
subcultures within what we consider our culture.
All right. American culture, by the nature of it, is pluralistic, so there are many subcultures that we may find. Is there any way in which American culture pervades these subcultures? I've just given you a hint when I said it was pluralistic. In order for it to be pluralistic, it has to be a situation in which it has been drilled into our minds that there are many truths that are all equally valid and that all of them are up to the individual. Would you say that that's an American way of looking at life? All right, so the deity in that way of looking at things becomes tolerance. Not only tolerance, I would say tolerance would have been the watchword 25 years ago. This is how I look at things. I think that American culture, about the time I was sending my children to school to start with, I think tolerance was becoming the ingrained word. I believe now we have progressed beyond that. I think now the watchword is validation. It's not only the tolerance of any way that someone wants to live, but the validation of these things as equally worthwhile and as equally acceptable and as equally desirable. Now, in order to do that, we've passed through something called multiculturalism, in which we have been taught that, a form of that applied to every way of living. Where we as Christians are taught that in Scripture that God loves all people and that Christ has given himself up for us all and that the gospel is to be carried to every creature and that anybody anywhere who calls on the name of the Lord can be saved and all of that. What the predominant culture would hold is that all of these are fine like they are, and that none should be disturbed, for example, by the preaching of the gospel that Stephen is talking about there. Now, here are some ways of thinking about this that I think might be helpful to us. The culture, as we will use it in this class over the next several weeks, will refer to the predominant mindset, the opinions, accepted norms of looking at life and of forming values and opinions and so forth that you will find in the academy or in academia and in entertainment and I'll just use the word the political realm. And in the information processing part of our lives, in the opinion forming part of our lives, this marker, I'm going to do something you've not seen me do. I'm actually going to get rid of it, okay? we try to get all the use out of them. So that's the kind of thing that we're talking about here. Now, I want to ask the second question that most of you are here today because you share a Christian worldview. So I want to ask, in what ways currently does it become most obvious to you that you are not a part of that culture, that you are, to use my word up here, a pilgrim? What, in which ways currently do you realize that the way you look at life as a Christian is different from the way it's found in these everyday parts of our lives right now?
Seems to me like, in general, the opinion is that everything goes except Christianity.
All right. So so if I were to say, Carl, that I sometimes feel like that the only unacceptable way to think, act, talk, and believe right now is a Christian way of doing it. The only thing that you can, in our culture right now, that you can ridicule, make fun of, and it still be politically correct, is faith in Christ.
Truth is not subjective.
All right. That idea, if you think that there is objective truth, you feel like you're out of step with the culture right now. Any other ways?
I think that society has much of a naturalistic worldview, where we have a different worldview, and so they try to really just take spiritual things completely out of it. So when we're talking about objective truth, it's really not just Christian truth. It's any kind of truth that comes from something different than from a natural way of looking at it.
Let me diagram what Stephen is saying here, if I can, a little bit. The two ways of thinking about life, if you take the naturalistic worldview, here would be the universe. And in the universe, there would be man, trees, snails, rocks. There would be animals. There would be gods. And the universe is a closed reality, and each of these things exist within the universe. The Christian worldview, on the other hand, is that this is the physical universe. This is the world in which there are rocks, I won't write them all up here, but trees, plants, animals, and all of that. And that here is, here, and I don't by the size of my circles mean to indicate anything about the weight of these things, but here is God. And that God, notice, exists on his own outside of the universe. He was not created by the universe. He's not a product of the thinking of man, but he is who he is. And then there is man, who is a part of both worlds. That he has a divine aspect of his being, and he's also a physical creature. That he's made in God's image, but he's also a physical creature. Now, can you see that those are two different ways of comprehending reality and truth? In this system of thought, truth comes from within the universe itself, so by nature, there is no objective standard to decide it. It is whatever anyone in it wants it to be. In this, however, there is truth which arises from who God is. And God has, the God who rules over the universe has the ability and by his nature to determine what reality is like and what it's about and so on. So that is a way of doing it. Now, how do I notice that my values are different? Well, I notice what's said about life. And I have a little grandchild now who was born 1 hour and 20 minutes before the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. There are a lot fewer people like him in the world now than there would have been otherwise. I notice what's said about marriage. About what marriage is and what it means. And I observe that the administration of the President of the United States filed a brief to argue before the Supreme Court this past week to insist that any initiative in any state which says that marriage is between a man and a woman should be overturned. And I notice that several of the best-known leaders of the other party also filed a brief, a friend of the court brief, with the Supreme Court this past week to argue the same thing. It therefore is not simply a political matter of a party, it is a worldview matter. Here's the way I notice it. If I had watched any of the Oscars presentations last week, I would have noticed that the predominant culture has very, very different views of what life is about and what's important in it than I have as a Christian. There are some more subtle ways in which this happens. I brought with me this morning a little book. I don't recommend it to anybody. It's a little book written by someone who shares maybe my world view as a Christian, but not my faith convictions. I'll say it that way. And I want to read you something of what this person says, because I believe it illustrates my point on a more subtle, everyday level, how this impacts us. And we'll get to 1 Peter and 2 Peter in just a second here, but this writer says that the readers of 1 and 2 Peter were people for whom Christianity was a minority group whose commitment to an exclusive monotheism, in other words, one God. I'm certain that Stephen has faced some of this in West Africa as well. The idea of commitment to an exclusive monotheism inhibits complete assimilation into the larger pagan environment. The idea is that the readers of these two books were originally probably the majority of them Gentiles. I'll show as we study through the book why I think this. And their lives had changed dramatically, and that meant that they were now different from their families, they were different from their communities, they were different from the general outlook of their religious leaders. And this person writes, Christians face irrational hostility because they have broken the cultural ties that bind when they adopted their new faith. Now, Here's where we get to the parts of it I want you to think about. Many Christians today feel that an era of easy accommodation between Christianity and culture is ending. I'm not sure this was ever real or not, but I do know we went through the accommodation or the tolerance view. Can't we all just get along of a few years ago? Now many feel that this era is ending and that because of secular pluralism has no place for religious convictions, practices, and celebrations in public life. And this writer talks about how with some of the holidays, the parents were distressed when their children were told to fill in winter solstice instead. Then the writer asked, should we permit the schools to teach our children that Jewish and Christian beliefs are just like the ancient pagan ones? And then she notes that the writer notes how James draws on the teachings of the Old Testament to emphasize the commands to love one's neighbor and to care for the poor, and to challenge the established views of wealth and power and prestige. And she says many Christians today find themselves caught in a lifestyle that has exalted things over persons. She talks about how her group wrote a letter to their community questioning the wisdom of letting athletic events and teenagers' jobs cut into time for worship and for families on Sunday, and how they got an ugly, ugly letter from the school superintendent because of that in that community. And then I think this next part is enlightening for us. She writes, the tensions between the methodological atheism of science and technology. Now, when I mention that, what do you think of? Evolution? Is that the main thing you think of? Listen to this. And the religious perception of human persons that surface now, Christians recognize that biblical authors describe the categories of belief that their readers are having to confront, like in 2 Peter, where the idea is that everything has always continued like it is and it always will. That idea stems from the Epicurean idea that you ought to eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die, and not from science or technology. But we face the same outcome from the philosophy of science and technology. Now, the problem of how knowledge gleaned from a scientific perspective that only recognizes religion as a human phenomenon, a form of human behavior, shapes our understanding of faith, and it remains an issue for believers. Now, here's her illustration. Several high schoolers in our congregation reported conflicts with their biology teacher. Now, you have a form an idea of how you think this is going to unfold, but listen. The issue was not evolution, but the soul or the mind. They were required to learn that all human thought, feeling, and activity was completely controlled by brain states. The soul, she insisted, was merely a leftover from the pre-scientific view of the world. Now, you know, don't you, that is what we're dealing with when we talk about culture like this. Now, here's where we want to take a minute to consider, if we can, the ways in which 1st and 2nd Peter can help us to think about this a little bit. Now, I realize I'm going to be asking to read through these two books in a more tunnel vision way than you might otherwise. But please observe the language of this book. Look at these books. Look at 1 Peter chapter 1, if you will. Two terms in verse 1. That are mentioned. The first term, well, let's read it here and think about it. Brenda, 1 Peter 1, verse 1 and 2, please.
Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who reside as aliens scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia, who are chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father, by the sanctified work of the Spirit, to obey Jesus Christ and be sprinkled with His blood. May grace and peace be yours in the fullest measure.
All right. Please observe in that first verse, the term, I think in the King James, it's strangers, isn't it? Isn't that right? And I'm on a right about that. In the other versions, it will be some form of the word exile. And that term, if you try to break it down and look at its background, refers to someone who lives alongside those who are of a different country than he is. In other words, he lives in the midst of foreigners. He lives in the midst of some, in the neighborhood of people who talk a different language, who look at things in a different way, who have different traditions and a different culture and a different background altogether. And Christians are that. That's how Peter addresses his readers. They are strangers, and then they are scattered. They are the diaspora. The term that was used for believers under the Old Testament when they were taken from Israel and Judah and carried off captive and then scattered to the four corners of the world as a result of that. And the idea here is that they live among people who are strangers, and they are way off from home themselves. And you recognize that he's talking here in symbolic ways. The places that he mentions here in verse 2 are all in what would have been Asia Minor, and what now would be in the nation of Turkey. And these are regions where maybe they were, there were a few Jewish backgrounds, but most of them would have been people who were converted to Christ through the preaching of the gospel, who found themselves as strangers in their own country in that way, but who were like folks who were scattered from home. Romeo?
I'd like to mention my translation is saying the elect exiles, meaning that they are called by God, that they are residents of an eternal city, which doesn't belong on earth, and they are strangers in that respect, and they follow God's rule and God's law. And that's what we're demonstrating. And we're all scattered about the world doing God's work.
Yeah.
And we can't compromise that in any way, shape, or manner.
The idea that they are not strangers simply because they wanted to act odd, but because God chose them. It's because they belong to God that they are. We'll study the elect part of this a little bit more, certainly as we go through this book, as we work our way through the text. But the impact of God's having chosen them, or their being people who belong to God, is that to the world, or in comparison to the world, they are exiles who are scattered and away from home. Now, a second thing, we'll have to go with this faster than I wanted to, but the second thing, look in verse 17 of chapter 1, and especially the end of the verse here. What does it say? Tim?
If you address as Father the one who impartially judges according to each one's work, conduct yourselves in fear during the time of your stay on earth.
All right, the time of your stay on the earth is translated, it uses the same word, that your stay on earth is a form of this same word. So the time of your life here is the time of your exile. And as Romeo just mentioned, this implies that you are a citizen of a country that is not an earthly country, and you are living away from home while you're here. So the time of your exile, and obviously that means that you don't take on the same character as the temporary part of this. All right, look down at chapter 2 and verse 11. Think about this. Somebody read this one for us. 1 Peter 2, verse 11.
Behold, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul.
All right, the aliens and strangers. I like the old way this is said, sojourners and pilgrims. I think, is that the way the American Standard, the King James says it? Okay. Sojourners means that you're people who are in a place for a little while, and you're just passing through. All right? Each of these, I think, remember the old song was saying, this world is not my home, I'm just passing through, my treasures are laid up somewhere beyond the blue. Aren't you glad I didn't sing it? that idea is certainly here. Now, look at chapter 4 and verse 4. Someone read this one for us quickly.
In regard to these, I think it's strange that you do not run with them in the same blood of participation, speaking evil of you.
All right. So they think it's strange that you don't run with them into the same debauchery, the same wild and riotous living, the same behave, the same ungoverned conduct and way of talking and way of living and way of speaking. Now, are you getting the idea that our time is not, we don't have a unique philosophy that has just dawned on American society within the last 20 years. We have this thing that the devil only has certain ways of thinking that he can offer you or me, and we, the varieties of them that we have to try to battle now have always been here in one shape or another, and nowhere is this more clear. I brought with me something that was written, of course, a translation of it, but the Roman historian Tacitus, probably the most famous in his Annals, which covers the period of A.D. 14 to A.D. 68. And this is his Annals, volume 15, and at number 44, he writes about what happens during the reign of Nero, who died in A.D. 68, by the way. Nero did, and how he fastened the guilt of what he himself had done on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hand of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and the most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Accordingly, an arrest was made first made of all who pleaded guilty, that is, to being Christians. Then, upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of firing the city, which Nero had done, as of hatred against mankind. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired. Now, you can observe in that what happened to them started with the maligning speech, the regarding of what Christians believed as a terrible, disgraceful evil, and a mischievous doctrine, and so forth, that happens. Now, one other part of this that let me do something else instead. There is another part that I just want to mention, that in response to this, our books are going to say two things. They're going to say first, 1 Peter 5 and verse 14, this is the true grace of God. Stand firm in it. And then it's going to say in 2 Peter, this grace, what God has made known to us, is sufficient for all things that provide for life and godliness. Those are the two convictions that we have to have in order to survive being strangers in an alien culture. Now, what I want you for us to do as we read, and next week we're going to start our way through the text. 1 Peter chapter 1, if you would please be prepared for us to discuss at least all the way down through verse 7. And please read it this way. When I think like this says, in what ways that I can identify does this make me different from the the popular culture of our day. Will you do that? How does this, what is this saying about how I as a Christian think? And how does this make me different from the everyday culture around me? And we have to exercise ourselves spiritually in this way, to first to identify what it is we believe, and second to be able to minister to the world that we're surrounded by every day. And then if I can remember, this life here is just the time of my exile. And I wanna be preparing to go home. That's what I wanna do. And if we can do that, it'll help us, I believe. I appreciate y'all being with us today.
It seems to me like that there's something that sticks out here in my mind on this, and that is that this group is a minority and always will be a minority.
Yeah, that's a thought-provoking thing. We all want to be liked, and we wish we were the majority, but I think Carl is right in his observation there about that. Thank you guys for being with us.